Good morning. Today's reading is from the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 26. Along the way, they came across a man named Simon, who was from Cyrene, and the soldiers forced him to carry Jesus' cross. Then they went to a place called Golgotha, which means skull place. The soldiers gave him wine mixed with bitter gall, but when he had tasted it, he refused to drink it. After they had nailed him to the cross, the soldiers gambled for his clothes by throwing dice. Then they sat around and kept guard as he hung there. At noon, darkness fell across the whole land until 3 o'clock. At about that time, Jesus called out with a loud voice, "Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you abandoned me?" Some of the bystanders misunderstood and thought he was calling for the prophet Elijah. One of them ran and filled a sponge with sour wine, holding it up to him on a reed stick so he could drink. But the rest said, "Wait, let's see whether Elijah comes to save him." Then Jesus shouted out again, and he released his spirit.
Good morning. Well, as Matt mentioned, we are in a series called Questioning Jesus. In fact, this is the official midpoint of the series. This is the hump. So after today, it's all downhill, right? So, well, Matt's up next week, so, you know, it will definitely be funnier next week than it is this week. And we've been using this word questioning not as a verb, but as an adjective, that Jesus is the questioner, that he asks questions of people all the time. In fact, his favorite response to the questions people had for him was a question back. And he used some of his questions were Socratic, and some were rhetorical, and some were sincere. But all of them, all the ones that we've considered so far, and I would say, really, if not the vast, almost all of them, are questions between Jesus and other people. But today we're going to look in a different direction, and we're going to see that Jesus had at least one question for God. I'm not sure that I can't think of any others, but some of you may want to prove me wrong. But this is a question that Jesus asked to God, and it's, let me put it on the screen. It's, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And which is it's a dark question. It's kind of appropriate for a gloomy day. My God, why have you forsaken me? And so we're going to dig into that this morning and look at that question. And interestingly, the answer to that question, like the context of that question, answers several questions for us. It answers questions that we have about suffering, and it answers questions we have about trust. So we're going to take this, as we typically do, in three parts. We're going to look at Jesus' question for God first and just look at the context of it, where it came from, what it might mean. And then we're going to look at Jesus' question for God and our struggle with suffering. And that's a part of life and how there's a connection. We're going to unpack that. And then third, we're going to look at Jesus' question for God and our struggle to trust. Jesus' question for God and our struggle to trust. So we start with Jesus' question for God, then we move on to suffering, and we move on and close with trust. Mark and Matthew, both recorders of Jesus' life, they end his earthly life on the cross with this question. These are Jesus' last words in their account of his life. Now, it's true that Jesus, it says, he said these words, my God, why have you forsaken me? And then there was a pause, and then he cried out again, and then he actually physically died. And Luke says that Jesus' last words were, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." And John says Jesus' last words were, "It is finished." And so there is a space in there in Mark and Matthew's accounts for Jesus to have said those things. But Matthew and Mark end on a darker note. They end with this phrase, my God, why have you forsaken me?" So I just want to just walk you through some of the things that led up to that, and what Jesus may have meant or even been experiencing when he said those words, as we begin with this first part of the message on Jesus' question for God. So this comes at sort of a pinnacle experience during the last week of Jesus' life. He had, the week began what seemed very positively. Jesus entered Jerusalem. He was received as a king, as a rescuer. He was celebrated. He seemed to be able to move around freely. And yet, there was a cloud that sort of hung over his head, and it was dripped into some of the things he said. In fact, it had been for quite a while. One of the really interesting things about Jesus that we see in every single account of his life is that he anticipated the fact that he would be put to death. He anticipated that on the other side of that death, he would rise from the dead. And so in their own way, each gospel writer talks about this multiple times. The first time we see it in Matthew is in chapter 16, and Jesus says, "It's necessary for me, the Son of Man, to be betrayed, to be handed over to the authorities, to be executed, but I will rise again." And so he says this over and over again. And in John's gospel, he says it a little differently. He says, I lay down my life only to take it up again. That's in John chapter 10. And so there's a sense that this is expected, that this is anticipated. And there's also a sense that he knows there's going to be a happy ending on the other side of it. But that doesn't seem to take away from the pain and the anguish and the trauma of the ordeal that Jesus went through. And that ordeal began with betrayal. Jesus was betrayed by Judas, one of his 12 disciples, and he was handed over to the authorities. And handed over meant he was bound, and he was dragged before four different tribunals, all on trumped-up charges, no justice whatsoever. No one had the interest, had justice as their goal. It was all about political expediency and what to do with him, and jealousy from some of the religious authorities. It was a travesty of justice. And in the course of that experience, he was beaten, he was punched, he was mocked. And eventually, very reluctantly, Pilate condemned him. And when Pilate condemned him, that set in motion Roman justice, which involved a flogging and more mocking. Purple robe was put on him because he was charged with being a king of the Jews. Crown of thorns. He had no sleep. He was beaten up. Oftentimes, prisoners would die just by being flogged by the Romans. So he was barely alive at this point. And then he was commanded and ordered to take his crossbeam and carry it outside the city where he would be executed. And apparently he was too weak to do so, and this man named Simon was tasked with carrying the beam for him, at least part of the journey, part of the way. And then Jesus was crucified, which is one of the cruelest, most gruesome means of execution that human beings have ever devised. So the victim was nailed to a crossbeam through the wrists so they wouldn't fall off the cross. And then that crossbeam was hoisted up onto the vertical, and their legs were twisted sideways, and a single spike was driven through their ankles. And what this did is it made it very, very difficult for the crucified victim to breathe, because they would have to push up on their legs. And so crucifixion was essentially, it wasn't a death by bleeding to death. It was a death where you slowly suffocated, sometimes over the course of up to 2 days. It was just brutal. And while you're stripped naked, hanging on this wooden structure, your enemies and detractors would come and hurl insults at you. Because it was obvious, even if it wasn't Jesus, it was obvious that you were cursed by God to be killed in such a brutal way. So that's what they did to him. That's where he was. He didn't last several days. He was only on the cross for 6 hours. And towards the end of his time on the cross, physically exhausted, emotionally exhausted, he utters this phrase, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which is an Aramaic phrase. Jesus spoke Aramaic, which is a derivation of Hebrew. And it meant, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Some of the people that were there didn't understand what was going on, and they thought he was calling for Elijah. Now, Elijah was one of the Jewish prophets. He was long dead, but there was sort of some superstition that he had mystical powers and might appear at various times to rescue people. So there was sort of some intrigue around that. And then he cried out, but nothing happened. And he cried out, and he gave up his spirit. So this is one of the most puzzling things that Jesus said. How can the Son of God, who knew this was going to happen and knew that there was going to be a happy ending on the other side, how could he feel abandoned by God the Father? How could that happen? What was going on? So one explanation is that, you know, the gospel accounts are kind of a shorthand. They give us summaries of what was said and done, which is entirely plausible, by the way. And since Jesus is starting to quote Psalm 22 when he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? In the actuality, he went all the way on to the end of the psalm where the psalmist writes that God has been faithful and God has taken care of him. And so this is sort of a, you know, we don't have the whole story, but it actually, he was fine kind of explanation, which I think doesn't do justice to any of the text or the suffering he went through. Sort of an opposite perspective, which would be the skeptic's perspective, would be to say, see, this statement proves that, you know, Jesus really wasn't who he said he was. I mean, he obviously miscalculated in some way. Either he miscalculated the determination of the Romans and the Jews, or he miscalculated God's willingness to intervene on his behalf, and he literally found himself in a position that he had not anticipated and truly felt hopeless and in despair, and was just coming undone. And you know, some people try to cut and paste and decide what Jesus really said or what he didn't really say. Well, this is one of those phrases they say, he really said that. You know, nobody would include that. It's not very flattering. And he must have really said that. And maybe this whole thing was not quite what he thought. A third option, and I think the better option, is that Jesus temporarily experienced the agony of being disconnected from his relationship with his Father. And in that moment of agony, he cried out in pain. Now, for some insight on that, we turn to the writing of Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 5. I'm going to show you a phrase here. In reflecting on what Jesus did for us, what God did for us through Jesus, Paul says, God made him, Jesus, who had no sin, to be sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. You know, one of the fundamental understandings of Christ and what he came to do for us is that he accomplished something for us. Actually, God accomplished something for us through him in that he took the guilt and the sin and the stain that was on us and he put it on him. He made him who knew no sin to be sin so that we could be freed from the guilt and the power of our brokenness. And so when Jesus cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? In that moment, he is experiencing the spiritual disconnect from God that comes from bearing the sin of the world in that moment. And so we call it the cry of dereliction. It's the pinnacle of his suffering. It was bigger than the physical ordeal that he went through. It was bigger than the emotional ordeal that he went through. There was something very spiritually significant going on when Jesus was on that cross. Literally, the guilt and the evil of all of human history was on his back, and it interrupted his communion with God, and he felt abandoned, and he cried out in pain, my God, why have you forsaken me? And this experience, this question that Jesus has for God, really answers two questions for us. And even as we look at those answers, we'll hopefully understand a bit more about what he went through and why. But the first question has to do with suffering. So we move from the first part about just about Jesus' question and into the second part of the message where we say, how does Jesus' question relate to our struggle with suffering? I think at a certain level, all of us struggle with suffering. We struggle with it in the sense that we may be in some form of it right now. And I don't know about you, but when I'm in some kind of form of acute difficulty, I just want it to be over as soon as possible. That's my top objective. And when I'm not in acute difficulty or suffering, I'm waiting for the other shoe to fall. Yeah, I really don't like the fact that the way life works is that we're vulnerable to these twists and turns in our lives that can send us into a world of hurt relatively quickly and sometimes without warning. And it seems that as time goes on, I'm at least more aware of all the different ways that can happen. The suffering isn't one of my favorite things. And if it should not be one of yours as well. If it is, we have a counseling ministry we'll send you to. But Jesus' suffering helps us understand our own. And there's four different things that I just want to say about this. The first is Jesus shows us that suffering is normal, that it's a normal part of the journey. And his whole life built up to this point where he suffered in a very, very, very deep and terrible and significant way. But it was really what his calling was, it was really what his mission was, and it was a normal part of life. See, we tend to think of suffering as a detour. And for him, it was actually the end game. We tend to think that suffering is always caused in one way or another by somebody's failure. And in a sense, maybe that's true even in Jesus' case, but it was also the right play. It was the right choice. It was the thing that needed to happen. I was talking to a friend this week, and he was telling me about his brother who died 2 years ago of lung cancer. And he said whenever he tells somebody that his brother died of lung cancer, their first question is, was he a smoker? Because we automatically assume with lung cancer, culpability of smoking. In his brother's case, it wasn't caused by cancer. Yet lung cancer doesn't get a lot of attention, because it's kind of got a bad brand, there's not a lot of resources to help his brother fight his cancer. It's kind of interesting. But the point is that we associate suffering often with some form of failing, some sort of culpability. And sometimes that's true. Sometimes we make our own messes. Sometimes it's not true in the sense that we just are experiencing some of the normal forms of suffering that happen to us in our lives. And sometimes, suffering is actually the right choice to voluntarily choose a course that's going to be challenging or difficult. That is certainly what Jesus is. But the bottom line is that suffering is a normal part of our journey in this life. It's not a sign of failure or that you took a wrong turn. It's just part and parcel of it. Jesus told his followers they should expect trouble. They should expect suffering. If this is what happened to him, we're not going to get away suffering free. It just doesn't work that way. The second thing Jesus shows us is what to do with our suffering. He takes it to God. Even though he feels abandoned by God, he's still talking to God. He's still venting to God. And a few weeks ago, we talked about grieving. That was May 29th. And if you'd like to dig into this idea more about what we do with our pain and our loss and our suffering, you can go back and listen to that talk from the 29th. But Jesus is taking it to God, following the pattern of the Psalms, one on which he's quoting. But the Psalms take all the pain to God. They vent it to God. You know, I wonder if our prayers are that honest. Like sometimes our prayers are exercises in denial. This is just very real. Jesus is owning his existential pain and taking it to God. The third thing I would say about suffering, and it's not in the text, but it's in reflections on Jesus' suffering in the book of Hebrews, is that because Jesus suffered, the text says in Hebrews, the author of Hebrews says, he can understand and empathize with our suffering. That he understands this world of brokenness and pain and loss and sin, and that he has an empathy for us, a sympathy for us, that he plays this role of high priest, this mediator between us and God, and he can relate to our pain. And finally, I think it's worth noting that Jesus' suffering was voluntary, that this is what he did by choice to rescue you and to rescue me. That in the course of God's plan for Jesus and for human history, he needed to embrace suffering. And you know, I like the idea that God will sort of soften suffering in my life, maybe insulate me for some suffering in my life, get me out of it quickly. But the idea that I would be asked to voluntarily suffer, that I would make myself intentionally vulnerable, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that at all. I want to stay as safe and comfortable as possible in my life. And if you get in my way, then I'll make you suffer, right? But I really don't want to do that. I don't really want to do that. But that's what Jesus did. He voluntarily chose to suffer. And it's really an amazing thing. It's really an amazing thing. And I think I just want to say a word to those of you who have been around the faith a while. Now, there's lots of one of the words we use for those of us who have been around the faith a while. We talk about the mature Christians. You know, what if our maturity is measured? You know, maybe it's measured in what we know or other things. But what if it's also measured in how much we're willing to step in and suffer. You know, to bear with those who are messy or needy or demand our time and we don't feel like we have it. You know, to give when we really, it's not convenient, whether it's time or money or some other resource. You know, we can define maturity in a lot of different ways, but what if we looked at Jesus, who at the pinnacle of his life, the right play was to choose to suffer, to bear the cost, to bear the pain, to carry it all. You know, what if we redefine maturity that way instead of a head knowledge thing or getting everything right? I don't know. I just want to just lay that before you and invite you to ponder it. Because I think the longer we go in our lives, the more we kind of just want God to take care of us. And we don't always embrace the full dynamics and even cost of what that could mean. So Jesus' question for God in our suffering. Suffering's normal. Suffering is something we can vent to God. Something is something that God does mitigate. He softens for us because now he can empathize with our suffering. But suffering is also something that sometimes he calls us to voluntarily embrace because it's going to be a channel through which he brings his love and his grace and his truth to others. That's what he did for us, and sometimes that's what he's going to call us to do through our journey in this life. So that's the second part. And then the third part of the message this morning, which is another implication, has to do with our struggle, or Jesus' question for God and our struggle to trust. And if you really think about it, if you're saying, well, Chip, you're suggesting that this God who I can't see sometimes is going to he's actually going to invite me to do things that are really hard and painful and difficult. That's really hard to believe. It's hard to want to believe. And it gets a little bit at this, what I call the struggle to trust. So what is the struggle to trust? You know, for some of us, the struggle to trust is really a factual thing. Did Jesus exist? Is all this true? Did he really die on a cross that way? Did he really raise from the dead? You know, can we really trust with any degree of certainty these biblical accounts of who he was, who he claimed to be, what happened, and so forth? It's a struggle to trust at a factual level. And that may be very real for some of you. And, you know, we think that with an open mind and a little bit of effort, you can get answers to those things. And you find that there are people that have done a lot of work and a lot of research and a lot of put a lot of effort into cataloging the historical reasons why we can believe Jesus is true. And, you know, when you kind of combine some of those things with the fact that there really are some intelligent people that believe this stuff, maybe you can get past that kind of struggle with trust. And then, so there's that kind of struggle with trust. But then there's another struggle with trust. And it gets into, will I really entrust myself to him? And we dove into this a bit last week when we talked about how, you know, God is really inviting us to give up our own, we called it a kingdom, and surrender to his, which is all about who sets the agenda for my life, who determines what's really important. It's pretty foundational. It's a pretty high level of trust. And it gets into this kind of real-time, real-life trust with the things that matter to us, the things we worry about. So if you're struggling with a health challenge, you worry about that, and you wonder, how am I going to get through this, and am I going to get better, and what if I don't? Some of us just struggle with trusting God with the fact that we're vulnerable to physical challenges. Or it could be work and finances, like that's a big area of our lives. And, you know, choices we make, decisions we might make, sacrifices we might make of our career trajectory for other things that might be more important, those types of things, that's an area where it's hard to trust. And then if we open up the door to the realm of any kind of relationships that matter to us, romantic relationships, relationship with a spouse, parent, kid, friends, those types of things, this is where we live. These are things we really care about. And I'm suggesting we struggle to trust God in those areas at times. Especially when it becomes apparent that we may need to give up something we want in the near term for something better in the long term. That's hard. But I actually would suggest that the trust that Jesus is asking for is even harder still. You know, some of us, I think, our perception of God and what he looks for is basically religious achievement, that he has a set of rules, and, you know, we can learn those rules and we can execute and we can achieve a sense of standing with God. And some of us, that's very traditional. We come from a very traditional frame, and it's, you know, it's all about, it's about the Bible, and it's about going to church, and it's a very traditional Christian view of things. For others of us, we don't like that version at all. We're much more of, we'd say we're spiritual, but not religious. And so we like, there's still rules, though. And there's still practices that you have to engage in to tap into the spiritual realities of the universe. And so if you do those things, you know, you become enlightened and you become whole. And both groups are in an achievement mindset with God. And ultimately, your trust is not in God or a higher power or whatever, however you say it. It's really in yourself. It's on you're trusting yourself to execute and to do the right things to get from God what you want. And then there's sort of another version, which I call God as hedge. And this is that, you know, most of the time, we live like we're an atheist or an agnostic. We do our own thing. We're the captains of our fate. We trust primarily in ourselves and our own insight and our own abilities to navigate and to make our way through. And then when it all hits the fan, we say a prayer. You know, or we face some ultimate challenge, or we think we're going to die. You know, we're ready for some expression of faith. But it's very short-lived, and we move on from it very quickly. This is not what I'm talking about when I'm talking about trust. When I talk about trust, I'm talking about what Jesus, I think, was looking for, which was a whole life active dependence on him. When Jesus invited people to trust him, I think he was talking about whole life active dependence on him. He was really talking about who we rely on to make our daily life work. He was really talking about who we're counting on to handle our spiritual failings and our brokenness and our sin before God. And, you know, what mechanism or person or reality are we trusting to make it all work? The relationship with God and the relationship in this world. And he wants to be the sole object of that trust. And I've spent all this time talking about what trust means because I think it's a big ask. He really is asking us for total trust, whole life, real-time dependence. And I think his cry on the cross is actually part of his pitch to us that he deserves that kind of trust. So if you were trying to get people to trust you, how would you approach it? People to listen to you, people to do what you want, people to trust you. I mean, you could, you know, replay 24 and pull a Jack Bauer and say, "Trust me." I really don't know why he doesn't have a voice, but anyway. Or you could play some form of the authority card. I'm the boss. You have to listen to me. I'm your dad. Do it. I'm your wife. And if I'm not happy, nobody's happy. Each of those approaches is coercive. It's coercive. It's forcing trust and compliance. Jesus doesn't do that. He doesn't say, "I'm God, trust me." End of conversation. This is really significant. Instead, he works to win us and woo us to a place where we voluntarily surrender to him. To win us and woo us to a place where we voluntarily surrender to him. Paul says it this way in Romans chapter 8. He really does. It's really there. There we go. "What shall we say about such wonderful things as these? If God is for us, who can ever be against us? Since he did not spare even his own son, but gave him up for us all, won't he also give us everything else?" In other words, stop worrying, stop stressing, stop wondering whether or not the suffering you go through is going to be worth it. God didn't spare his own son. God led his son to a cross where he cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me?" God gave everything to win you to himself. Jesus covered your sin debt so that you could know you're forgiven. The cloud is gone. And he forged ahead on a path of sacrifice, even though it meant coming to the lowest of lows, feeling forsaken by God himself. He did all that for you, for each of you. Not to hold it over your head and say, you have to trust me, but to say, I am eminently worthy of your complete and total trust. And I proved it on the cross. So stop worrying and stop holding out on me and stop waiting. Isn't it time to trust me completely? Because this is what I've done for you. Let's pray. God, the idea that in any way we would risk or even embrace voluntary trials or suffering, it just seems counterintuitive to getting ahead in life. And yet, the idea that anyone, particularly the very Son of God, would willingly take upon themselves our sin, our guilt, our abandonment, that they would embrace a moment of eternal and cosmic pain to win us forgiveness and life with you. That's even bigger. That's even more amazing. So Lord, this morning I ask that you'd help each of us move towards you in some meaningful way. That if it's to move to a place of saying, I haven't really fully understood this, I need to know more. And that we're going to take the path of an active seeker and find out that we would do that. Or for others of us who have heard these things now for a while in one form or another, that we just, it's time, we know, we need to surrender to you in faith this morning. Well, Lord, maybe it's for some of us to grow up in our understanding of who you are, what you ask, and what you offer. And we've embraced these things in a kind of elementary point of view for a long time, but it's time to grow up, to lean into them, and to share them with others. Lord, thank you that you loved us so much that you were willing to go through the whole ordeal of the cross, including that pinnacle moment where you said, my God, why have you forsaken me? In Jesus' name, amen.